Let's continue with our quest to find fermions in space-time. We said last time that that was the main problem that our nice and beautiful bosonic string had, which was that it seemed to be a nice theory that contains gravity, and it contains a gauge boson and things that we like, but it didn't have fermions. So it cannot possibly be a theory that describes nature. So what we did was to start with an action and we added fermions to it. But fermions on the world sheet, and these fermions were funny because they had an index which was a vector index in space-time. So we went on and found boundary conditions for the fermions, just as we did for the bosons. We found two boundary conditions. We found the Archon boundary conditions and the NS boundary conditions. We found the mode expansions, oscillators for each of the sectors. And we found the anti-commutation relations. So we found in the B sector something that looks like this. Where M and N are integers. So that was in the Ramon sector. Okay. We found in the Schwarz sector that something slightly funny had to happen with the indices. Where these guys had to be half integers in order to satisfy the funny boundary condition at sigma equals to pi. Okay? Very good. So we started to study the spectrum a little bit of the theory, and we said that on this side we can define a vacuum just as we did in the bosonic case. We have to define it in such a way that it's annihilated by all the annihilation operators, defined so that M is greater than zero. Okay? And here too, we should do the same thing with the fermionic oscillators. That all looks fine. And we should do the same thing here in the R sector. So in order to distinguish the different vacua, we'll put an NS here. And on this side, we should put an R. So we will define it in the same way. Remember, we're doing open strings here. Okay, so we define this to be annihilated by this, and the same thing will happen with these guys for M greater than zero. Okay, and here for R greater than zero. Okay, very good. Now, we ended the lecture by realizing something that ended up being very, very interesting, which was that the zero mode in the Ramon sector ended up satisfying an algebra that looks very, very exciting for us. Remember that our objective is to find fermions in space-time, and this algebra ends up looking precisely like a Clifford algebra. In a Lorentzian space-time of d dimensions. Okay? Well, naively you could say, well, maybe d is 26 as we did in last time. But we shouldn't take it for granted, and we should just leave it as an arbitrary d dimensions. We still don't know. Maybe the presence of the fermions will change something in the analysis we did. Okay? Very good. Now, what does this mean? Well, from last week's tutorial, you found that the representation of this algebra will end up giving us that these zeros will end up being represented by matrices of what size? Do you remember? Let's assume that D is even, just to be definite. So what's going to be the dimension of the representation of this algebra? Of the Clifford algebra? Maybe you don't recognize it like this, but imagine that we rescale things. And you have something like this. This you should recognize. This is what we did, what you guys did last week, right? During the tutorial. And there you found that these guys have a representation that has a very special dimension. Do you remember the dimension? Do you remember the idea? The trick was to write creation and annihilation operators with this guy, and you could apply them many, many times to produce states with plus or minus, and that will give you something that is necessarily, the dimension was a power of 2, right? Is that sounding familiar? Yeah, very good. So this will be a Dirac spinner, okay? If D is even. So the way to represent these matrices act on a vector space of dimension 2 to the D half. Okay, that's why they are they are matrices of this size. Okay, because they act on a vector space. The representation is a vector space. Okay, of this dimension. And these objects act on that, mixing the vectors in that vector space. Now the D zeros satisfy the same algebra, so they should also be objects of that form. That means that our vacuum better be a representation of this algebra, and therefore we should have as many states in the vacuum, in the ground state, as 2 to the d half, okay? If we are working with that representation. Depending on the space-time dimension, we could also have even smaller representations, right? This representation could be reducible. What are the smaller representations we could have? Very good. We could have vial representations. So in that case, we will remove a 1 here from each side. We'll have 2 to the d half minus 1. And we could also sometimes impose Majorana conditions, and sometimes we can impose both conditions. Okay? But we still don't know what the dimension of the spacetime is. So we better stay with d. Okay? We don't even know if the dimension is going to be odd. So if the dimension is odd, we don't have the possibility of having vial fermions, right? So let's not discuss what particular representation is going to be. Just all we know is that these D's will satisfy this Clifford algebra, and therefore they have to be represented by these matrices. And this means that our vacuum or our ground state is not unique. Okay? So we need as many states in the ground state as the dimension of the representation. So the ground state, yes, you see, as if we didn't have any A's in the story, let's just label the ground state by A. So A goes from 1 to 2 to the D half, okay? And what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen is that D0 acting on this, remember, this is going to be a matrix now. It's a matrix. Yeah. So, well, this is going to act on this, and it's going to produce, it's going to mix all these ground states following the corresponding representation. Okay. So that tells us that this set of ground states in the Ramon sector, they want to be a fermion in spacetime. At least they transform in the correct representation. What else do we need in order to make sure that this is actually a fermion in spacetime? It should satisfy an equation, right? There is a nice equation that tells us that something is a fermion in spacetime. What would be that equation? If you have a boson, well, the boson better satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, right? For this guy to be a fermion, what does he have to satisfy? Remember that we are producing on-shell states, right? So what do we need to find? The Dirac equation. Yep, so we need the Dirac equation. How on earth are we going to find a Dirac equation out of this whole thing? This looks almost impossible. Well, the reason that looks impossible is that I somehow cheated a little bit yesterday, okay? And you should have told me, look, you are cheating a little bit, because you started somewhere in the middle. You didn't start from the beginning. So in order to remember, or in order to realize where I cheated, this just, in 5 minutes, let's try to review everything we have done from day one. Okay? Well, maybe, I wonder if it's gonna fit here. It would be great if it did. Yeah, but it would, if I could use this part, but you won't probably see, so. Let's do it here. Okay, I'm gonna do it, but with your help, okay? Let's try to review everything we have done with the bosonic string. Okay, so we started in a little bit unconventional place. We started with a GR action, do you remember? We started with a GR action in any number of dimensions with a scalar fields, a cosmological constant, and so on. But well, that's not the way people usually start a string theory course, and I told you so. People would usually start by saying that they want to map a world sheet into space-time, so they want to find an action for a one-dimensional object moving there. Do you remember in the recipe for a theory of quantum gravity, I told you that perhaps you wanted to start by saying, well, I want to change a paradigm. So you can change the point particle paradigm by a standard object. So you would start by postulating the existence of this object and then trying to construct an action. So the action that you would naturally construct is not the action we started with. What action would you naturally write for this object? Do you remember this action? Where this g hat was what? What is it called? So there is some metric in space-time. So this g alpha beta was the pullback of that metric. Okay? So this is a way you compute the area of this object in space-time. So this is a space-time area that is, so this is time, okay? That this one-dimensional object, well, one-dimensional in the spatial dimensions, but when it moves in time, it expands this two-dimensional object, so it defines an area in space-time. So this was the natural way to define the action, okay? And we did this. But when people start from this point of view, they immediately tell you that this action is very, very hard to deal with, to find equations of motions, to solve them, to quantize it. And then they tell you that there is a nice trick you can perform, which is to introduce a new field, which is a metric on the world sheet. And then they write this action. And this was actually our starting point. Do you remember that? That was our starting point. Okay? And we said that if you integrate out this metric, you end up with this action. And this was called the Nambu-Goto action. or it's called the Nambu-Goto action, and this is the Polyakov action. Okay? Very good. So what did we do next? I did the first part. Now it's your turn. What was the next step? We didn't integrate out H because of what I said, right? That this action is hard to deal with. So what did we do? Very good. So we studied the symmetries and found that this has diffeomorphism invariance plus Weyl invariance. Okay? And we use that to do what? Excellent. But we had to remember something, right? There is a price to pay, and the price was the constraints. And the constraints came from varying, from imposing the equations of motion of this metric at all times. So the equations of motion were nothing but the energy momentum tensor had to vanish. Okay? So our action became something very simple. So this is the action with x and h. And this is the action after we gauge fix H to be the flat metric. Okay. And then it became something extremely simple together with the constraints. Okay. Excellent. What did we do next? Very good. With some boundary conditions. Okay? So we found closed strings, open strings with Neumann, Dirichlet boundary conditions. That's very good. And we found the oscillators. And what did we do with the constraints? We also did the same thing, right? We found the modus function for the constraints, right? So in order to do this, what we did was to go to the Lycom coordinates on the wall sheet. So we had sigma plus and minus. And then the action became very, very simple. Okay? And we found here that the energy momentum tensor had two non-trivial components, meaning that they don't vanish unless you impose that they vanish. Okay? The other components actually vanish automatically. Okay? So it's not a constraint. They just vanish. This is a reflection of conformal invariance, which we use later on. But at this point, it just happened that they vanished. So the constraints were that these things had to be zero. Okay. Now we did the modus function of these guys. We inserted the modus functions of the x's and found the modus functions for each of these ones. And we called the modes LMs, okay? And then we went on. What was the next step? So the constraints ended up being constraints, the classical constraints, that these all these modes had to vanish. So what was the next step? Do what? Yeah, so we did canonical quantization. Very good. So we did quantization. And when we did that, we found a problem, right? We found negative norm states. How do we solve the problem? Yes, so we know that even here, using the canonical quantization, which is fully covariant in space-time with respect to the Lorentz group in space-time, in principle, one should be brave and just use the constraints and get rid of all these guys. But I cannot blame you. I wasn't brave, so I didn't do that. So I used a trick. What was the trick? In space-time, we went to special coordinates. Do you remember the coordinates? We went to Lycon coordinates. What I'm saying is I wasn't brave enough in the following sense, that I was willing to give up manifest Lorentz invariance in space-time in order to simplify my life. So we did Lycon quantization. Okay. In the Lycon quantization, what happened was that we had these special coordinates. Okay. And we know that the dangerous oscillators, where do they sit? The dangerous oscillators sit in x plus and x minus. So if we can get rid of them, we will be in business. And these were called the transverse directions. Okay? So what was the magic that allowed us to get rid of these bad oscillators? There was some piece of magic that allowed us to transform this x plus into something very, very simple. So there was some magic that we had to do. What was it? Well, in order to get rid of an infinite number of things, perhaps you have to use a symmetry that has an infinite number of generators. You remember what was that symmetry? A symmetry of this action. Yeah, conformal symmetry. Which was a residual symmetry that was not gauge fixed when we did this. Okay? So we use a residual symmetry. Which is conformal symmetry. Which I remind you is just that allow us to change any, to change sigma plus and minus by any function of sigma plus minus. We use that in order to, in the new coordinates, which we call tilde, we use that to get rid of, completely kill all the plus oscillators, so we ended up with something that looks like this. Right? So we did half of the job with these things, but we still had the x minus oscillators. So what did we use to get rid of the x minus oscillators? Remember, we use the constraints, right? So we use a constraint, say this constraint, which is another form for these guys, right? That one is just a linear combination of these two. And then using this and using this, we found that x prime minus tau sigma ended up being a function of only the xi's, okay? And therefore, the only physical oscillators are the transverse oscillators, and they have beautiful commutation relations, and we were in business. So we were about to declare victory until what happened. So we said we have manifest unitarity. So we were about to declare victory, and we decided to do what? To check the spectrum. Yeah, you said, well, maybe you know what? We gave up manifest Lorentz invariance, so maybe we should check it. So we checked the spectrum. And checking the spectrum, we found that there was an anomaly unless this normal ordering ambiguity constant happened to be 1. And that motivated us to check the whole Lorentz algebra. And from the whole Lorentz algebra, we found that everything works out only if the number of scalar fields happens to be 26. Okay? Very good. Now you can tell me why I started the lecture by saying that I cheated yesterday, because I didn't start from the beginning. Where did I start it? When I introduced fermions. Where in the whole story I started? Yes, but that's very good, yes. But so where in the whole story I started to add the fermions?
Yeah.
I started here, right? So that's why I cheated. I should have started here. Or here. Okay? So today, what we're going to do is to start here. Okay? But, and this will lead to what we have been doing, the RNS formalism. But you could also imagine starting somewhere here. Okay? And that will lead to another formalism. In fact, that's related to a question that Hyung Han, no, Hyung, how do you say it?
Sort of.
More or less. Oh, no. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so you asked a question yesterday. I think I misunderstood the question somehow. But you can actually start from here and declare that perhaps your spacetime is actually not a bosonic manifold, but it's actually a super manifold that also has directions that are fermionic. But that somehow is assuming from the start that you're going to have something in spacetime that has a new symmetry, right? Because if you're starting with a spacetime that has translation invariance in the bosonic coordinates, and you're also adding fermionic coordinates, whatever that means, and you are also imposing translation invariance in the fermionic coordinates, you are imposing already that your theory will have space-time supersymmetry, which you already know our theory will have here because that's what you did in the tutorial yesterday. But that we found as a bonus. It wasn't something we put in. But nevertheless, you could start from that point of view and extend these guys to be the super coordinates here, and that goes under the name of the Green-Schwarz formalism. Okay, I don't think we're going to have time to discuss the Green-Schwarz formalism. Perhaps next week we can have, I mean, if some of you are interested, we can have a small discussion outside of the lectures, of the formal lectures, about the Green-Schwarz formalism. Okay, so we're not going to start from here. We're going to start from here. So what do we have to do? Well, from yesterday, you know that the action we got was supersymmetric, so we want to start with something that looks supersymmetric here. In four dimensions, do you remember this little exercise that I told you to do, starting with some particles with some helicity and acting with the supercharges and so on? So imagine that you have only one supercharge, and you have something of helicity minus two, and you act with the supercharge. What do you get? You get something with what helicity? Yes, minus 3/2, right? By CPT, you also have to add the other bit of the multiplet, okay? Starting with helicity 2 and then going down to 3/2. Now, this particle with a spin 3/2, with helicity 3/2, has a name. It's called a gravitino because it's a partner. Is a super partner of the graviton. Okay? That's what it's called. Now, the gravitino is a very strange animal. It's a fermion, so it's a spinner, but it has a space-time index. Okay? This would be in four dimensions, but since we are in two dimensions, we will just put an alpha. And we are not going to call it psi, we're going to call it chi. Okay? In four dimensions, people use different notations, but in two dimensions, we're going to call it like that. Okay? So this chi is a fermion, is a spinner in two dimensions, but it also carries a vector index. Now, for this guy to be the super partner of the graviton on shell, they have to have the same number of degrees of freedom. Now, this guy has too many degrees of freedom to be the partner of that guy. So we have to get rid of these degrees of freedom. If you want to get rid of degrees of freedom, what do you do? Imagine like in four dimensions when you have a gauge boson and you want to describe electromagnetic waves. You know that they are only transverse, right? So you need to add something as some principle to the action to get rid of some of the degrees of freedom of the gauge boson, right? What is that thing that you add? Well, you have to declare that the other degrees of freedom should not be physical. So there must be, your action must be invariant under some transformation, which are called gauge transformations. And the gauge transformations are the ones that allow you to say that those longitudinal degrees of freedom are not physical, okay? So whenever you want to get rid of degrees of freedom, you have to declare or you have to impose that there is some gauge symmetry. Now, this is a fermionic object, and we want to get rid of some of the degrees of freedom. So how can we do that? Well, we will have to impose some local invariance, some local symmetry. And since this is fermionic, this local symmetry, we have to have a parameter that is a Grassmann parameter. So we need to add local supersymmetry. So yesterday, when you studied this action with the fermions, you found that this was invariant under transformations that exchange bosons and fermions with a parameter epsilon that was a constant. It was a fixed Grassmann number. But in order to get rid of the extra degrees of freedom, we have to make epsilon a function of sigma. Well, by sigma, I mean tau and sigma, really. So we have to write an action that is actually invariant under local supersymmetry. Okay? It turns out quite nicely that such an action exists. And I'm going to write it for you. Not because you're going to use it, just. Well, if you have some free time, you can try to check that it's actually invariant under local supersymmetries. Then I'm sure it will be a lot of fun. But now let me ask you something else. Before we start to write down the Lagrangian, remember, we want to put these fermions in here, right? But now we have a metric. This is not a flat space anymore. We have a metric. So what do you have to do to put fermions when you have a curved manifold? Excellent. Or, let's say, is everybody familiar with this? Have you guys seen that in the course? How to include fermions when you have a curved manifold? Yes? No? Perhaps? Don't remember? Maybe? No? Oh, no? 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 Oh, I was kidding. I mean, I was sure you did. Okay, it's actually a whole triviality. The whole thing is that when you have a completely general manifold, the invariance you have is GL invariance, right? But the GL group doesn't have a spinor representation, so you need SO to have a spinor representation, as you know very well now. You know everything about spinor representations for SO groups, right? Very good. So, well, if the whole manifold doesn't have it, you can go to the tangent space, right? The tangent space actually has Lorentz invariants, right? Which is an SO group, which has spinor representations. So if you perform this trick, now these indices actually transform under the Lorentz group. And that's what your spinors are going to see, okay? Very good. So we're going to complete this. So we're not going to write it in terms of H. We're going to write it in terms of these guys. So we're just going to put here E. I'll keep this H here, but let me write the rest, just for fun. So these are the guys we were talking about yesterday, okay? The psis. This is a gravitino. When you see this, you may wonder, how come that people are actually able to find these things? And I think in 2 weeks you will have precisely the chance to ask somebody who might have found some of this himself in your course on supergravity. Here it is. That's your very first full supergravity Lagrangian, and probably the only one you will ever see completely written down. Okay. So this is a supergravity theory. All right. Yes. What do we do where?
This is the view right in the beginning. Yes, that one.
Yeah, this is a determinant. Right?
Yeah.
And this is a covariant derivative using the spin connection. Okay? Very good. Now we are ready. This was supposed to be our starting point yesterday, but I hope you can tell why I didn't choose it to be the starting point yesterday. It's not very illuminating. But having done it, okay, we can now go to the next step. What was the next step? Or what is the next step? You should all have it in your notes now, right? So the next step was to study the symmetries. Global and local. Okay? Well, but we know, well, in a space-time, it's the same thing as usual, right? It has Lorentz invariants, Poincaré invariants, in fact. Okay, that's good. But we know that we're more interested in the local symmetries. So we have, again, diffeo invariants, because it's a theory of gravity in two dimensions. So it's actually diffeo invariant. It still has a Weyl invariance, but it actually has more than that. It has a super version of Weyl invariants. Okay. So this whole part is only to motivate you. We're doing all this in order to just close the logical gap towards finding the constraints in the theory. As Eduardo predicted from the beginning, he said, well, what we need is to find the constraints in the theory, right? From the action we started yesterday, that action was completely fine. The problem was that we had no reason to impose constraints from that point of view, right? But now, starting from this action, we know that if we use this to actually go to a gauge where the metric is flat, the same thing we did for the bosonic part, okay? It turns out that the super version is powerful enough to allow us to go to a gauge where the gravitino is actually set to zero. That's why we didn't see it yesterday, okay? So diffeos plus Weyl plus super Weyl is powerful enough to allow us to choose a gauge where the metric is flat and the gravitino happens to be zero. If you look at this action and you plug that the gravitino is zero, this is gone, this is gone. This becomes the regular derivative, and we get back the action we started with yesterday. Okay? So using that, we get our nice action. Okay? But, as we said, we have to impose the constraints. You have a question? Well, that was in four dimensions. So remember remember the very concept of helicity being a half integer and so on has to do with a little group in four dimensions and so on. Okay? So this was only a motivation to say that here too you will have a partner for the graviton which will be a gravitino. Okay? Oh, the covariant derivative. Well, the covariant derivative is just a derivative with a like if you were doing a covariant derivative for a tensor, right? The derivative will have the Levi-Civita connection, right? Here, this guy is not acting on a tensor because it's not a tensor of the general manifold. It's actually a spinner in the tangent space. So the connection that you have to use is what is called the spin connection. Okay. Now it so happens that the spin connection also vanishes if you're in flat space-time. Okay. The spin connection is made out of these guys, but it vanishes if you're in flat space-time. So once we go to the flat case, this becomes the regular derivative. Okay. Contracted with the rows is what we call del bar. Okay. Well, I encourage you strongly before the course in 2 weeks, perhaps, to review or to learn how to write an action for fermions in a curved manifold. That's actually important to know. Okay, but we did all this just to go to this action. This was our starting point yesterday. So what did we gain? It seems that nothing, right? Can anyone tell me why did we do all this? The review and then all this and get here. What do we want to get? What's our goal? This action is missing something, right? We cannot just start with this action and pretend that that's our theory. What do we have to do? To impose the constraints. But you see, without doing all this, we had no way of knowing what the constraints had to be. Now we know that the price for choosing this gauge is that we have to impose the equations of motion of this field here as a constraint, okay? But that's the energy momentum tensor. Now we also have to do the same thing for the gravitino, and we will find what is called a supercurrent, and that will also have to be zero. Now the lucky thing is that we don't really have to vary this action in order to compute these things. The reason is that these are also the conserved currents of a symmetry here. Okay? What is a symmetry? Well, for the energy momentum tensor, this is the conserved current of translations on the wall sheet, right? So we can just start with this, perform a translation, and compute the conserved current, and that would be the energy momentum tensor. Likewise, we could perform a translation in the superspace, or we can perform a supersymmetry translation and find the current associated to that, and that would be this J. But I hope you appreciate that without going through all this, there was no reason to impose this as constraints. Of course, you can compute the conserved currents, but who tells you? What tells you that you have to set them to zero is actually this whole story. Okay? Now that we have done it, we can forget about this. And start all over again from our guys here and compute the constraints. Okay. So we're going to do it in Lycon coordinates. On the world sheet. Okay? So what is going to be our energy momentum tensor? Well, the T++ component, if you do the computation, it will end up being, of course, we're going to get this contribution. This is the same action that we had before. But we're going to get a contribution from the bosonic, from the fermionic fields. That contribution will be what? It will be something of this form. Okay? Perhaps with an I. I think I want to get all the factors right. Yeah, an I half. Okay? The same thing for T minus minus. How come I remember that this is del plus and not del minus? Because del minus will be zero, so that would be the equations of motion. Right, very good. In fact, you have to use that when you compute this thing. Once again, you will find that it vanishes. So the constraints will be this equal to zero, this equal to zero, and the supercurrent. The supercurrent turns out to be, well, it will have to be something that mixes these two guys, right? It turns out to be something like this. And J minus turns out to be something like this. Again, we have to impose that these objects vanish as the constraints. Any questions? Okay. Now we can continue exactly the same path we followed when we did the bosonic version. What's the next step? Well, the next step is to plug in all the modus functions we worked out very hard to get yesterday for x and psi, plug them here, and see what the constraints look like. So the modus function of these guys, we can get them, remember, by doing something like this. We can just project, integrate over sigma. We put an M here. That would be our LM. Okay? Now our Virasoro generator of our will have two contributions. We'll have the usual contribution, say we call it from X, and it will have a contribution coming from the fermionic part. The contribution from M, from X, is the same as before. Right? There is nothing really different here. So what do we have? We have something like this. Okay. Now this bit is going to be different depending on the sector, right? So let's see. What do we want to discuss first? Any questions? Well, it's just to project out the it's just a way of projecting out a particular component in the expansion. Remember, we had the expansion, we had e to the, we're doing the open stream, so the expansion is actually e to the I n sigma. Right? So in order to get something that projects out, give us something that is only one for a particular value of m and gives you zero everywhere else, we have to go in a range that is 2 pi in length. The sigma, yes. Yes, that's right. But remember, we're now doing the open string. And in the open string, in the closed string expansion, we had e to the minus 2i sigma. But in the open string, we don't have the 2. So in order to carry out this computation, we have to go from minus pi to pi. Okay, for these functions to be orthogonal to each other. Okay. Very good. So which sector do you want to do first? Which one?
The R
sector. I'll have to turn the page now. let's see. Well, you all have this, right? So you all remember what the J's are. Well, you already have it. So. Okay. So let's make Eduardo happy. So let's start with the R sector. Are you sure? You're going to make Nabil and Schwartz feel a little bit bad, right? So let's start with the R sector. So we now have to compute what LM is in the R sector. Well, this is just a straightforward computation, so let's not do it. Let's just write what the answer is. Okay, so that's the fermionic contribution. Can anyone tell me why we get these factors here and we didn't get these factors when we did something like this here?
Is this R sector?
Sorry? Yeah, I told you, I didn't want to start with the R sector. I was hoping you were going to change your mind. That's not my fault for asking. I mean, I'm lecturing, so I can choose which sector we start with. Yeah. Okay. Are you happy now? Thank you. Yeah, great. Well, the question is still valid. Why do we get this factor here? Well, in this case, we didn't get any factors in front. Are these really the oscillators, the creation operators and annihilation operators that are nicely normalized to be called harmonic oscillators?
No.
So that's the reason, you see. If we were to write this in terms of the natural harmonic oscillators, creation operators, and annihilation operators, we would actually get a factor in front. But why do so? I mean, it looks so beautiful like this that we should just leave it like that. In this case, these guys actually satisfy the correct anti-commutation relations to be called the honest creation and annihilation operators, fermionic ones. Okay. Now there is a convention for a name. So we also have to expand the current, the supercurrent. Okay, so we do the same thing. And the convention is to call, in the Ramon sector, is to call these guys FM. Okay, so now you will see the L's. the L's split into two pieces, but there would also be the F's. Now, by plugging the formulas in the Ramon sector that you had yesterday, that you have in your notes, you will find something like this. So now you see you're going to spoil the surprise. Now nobody will want to see the Navier-Schwarz sector after we see the Ramon sector. Well, note something interesting here. No matter which value of m we have, we don't have any normal order ambiguity because these two guys commute, right? So there is no normal order ambiguity anywhere. So that's at least nice. The only normal order ambiguity is still in L0. Okay? So let's define our physical states in the Hilbert space. So phi is physical if it's annihilated by the whole L, okay, the sum of these two guys, for any m greater than 0, by all f's, and last but not least, our friend with a normal order ambiguity. Now, this normal order ambiguity, we don't know what it is. And we might suspect that it might differ depending on the sector, so we should put an R here. Very good. Okay. Now here comes the surprise. Look at this guy, and let's see what this guy is acting on the vacuum. Remember, in the R sector, in the Ramon sector, the vacuum was this spinner, right? The ground state was degenerate, and there were 2 to the d half states, and they all nicely fit into a representation of the Clifford algebra in such a way that it becomes a spinner in spacetime. And what I want to do is now to see what F0 happens to be, the constraint that it vanishes. Oh, yeah, I'm talking about that, but I didn't put the equal sign here. There is no normal order ambiguity, so there is no reason I have to talk about F0 as an independent guy, right? So F0 must annihilate any physical state, okay? In particular, it has to annihilate all my states in the vacuum. So I'm going to suppress the spinner index. So there is an index now that tells me that this guy is really a 2 to the d half dimensional object. So I'm going to suppress that. Now let's see what F0 is. Okay? So we see from there that it happens to be, well, let me extract the zero piece from here and write the rest. So F0 looks like alpha 0 dot d0 plus a bunch of oscillators. Right? The remaining piece in the sum will just be a bunch of oscillators. Well, if you want, we can write them explicitly. So the sum m equals different from 0, dn. Okay? But acting on the vacuum, what happens to these guys when they act on the vacuum? Well, you get 0. By definition, they had to give you 0. Right? If it's not by these guys, it's by these guys. So it doesn't matter which term in the sum, you will actually annihilate the vacuum. So acting on the vacuum, F0 acting on our Ramon vacuum is only given by this. But what is alpha 0? Alpha 0 is proportional to what? To the momentum, right? So if our vacuum carries some momentum p, say, so alpha 0 is proportional to the momentum. And how about this zero? This zero is actually a matrix that is proportional to which kind of matrices? To the gamma matrices, right? Because it satisfies an algebra that is almost a Clifford algebra except for a factor of 2. So up to a square root of 2, this guy is actually a gamma matrix. But what is this? Do you recognize this equation? P dot gamma acting on something has to be zero? That's the Dirac equation. Now you see why nobody would want to see the Navier-Schwarz story now. Not only is it a Dirac equation, it's a Dirac equation for a particle that is massless. So we conclude that our vacuum here is actually a massless spinner. That's not bad. It's looking good. Last time we found only a bunch of tachyons. Now you're really going to hate the Navier-Schwarz sector. But let's do it. Yes?
Sorry, what is the P in the vacuum?
Remember, the vacuum, every state is an eigenvector of the momentum operator, right, in space-time. Okay? So the vacuum is defined in such a way that it's annihilated by all the annihilation operators of the oscillators. Okay? But it still carries some momentum. Okay, so let's do the other sector. Okay, in this case, this guy happens to be something of the form and the convention in this case is that the modes of the supercurrent are called GR. And they are given by where the R's are half integers. Okay? Pretty good. Okay. So once again, the same story repeats here. We have to impose that a physical state in the Navier-Schwarz sector is annihilated by all these guys. Now we replace the F by a GR. Now there is not really a problem with R equals to zero. It's not even in the set, right? Because we are only summing over half integers. And here, we should also allow for a normal order ambiguity. Okay, so let's actually study the spectrum. But before we move on to study the spectrum, remember what we did. The trick to do that, here we still have negative norm states everywhere, right? Unless we impose these constraints. And remember, these constraints were quadratic, and it's a pain to actually try to impose them. And I wasn't brave enough to actually do it. So we came up with a trick. What was the trick? In space-time, we did Lycon quantization. Pretty good. So let's do the same thing. So, yes?
Components P minus minus and J minus will give us a set of constants.
Well, not in the open string. In the open strings, these are enough. Yeah. These are the only independent ones. In the closed string, yes. Okay. So here again, we do our trick. And the same thing for the size. After all, they are vectors in space-time. Okay. Now we have to cross our fingers and hope that there is enough symmetry to do the same miracles that happened in the bosonic case. Okay. So remember, in the bosonic case, we had conformal invariants. Well, in this case, we have supersymmetry, and this conformal invariance turns into a superconformal invariance. Okay, so we will also have, in fact, we know that conformal invariants, the generators of conformal invariants, are the Virasoro generators. Now we know that they are supplemented by super generators, which are the G's, and they form a nice algebra. We're not going to write it down, but they form what is called the superconformal algebra. Okay. And this superconformal algebra has a central charge and all that story. Perhaps we will do the same thing as with the Green-Schwarz formalism. Depending on the interest, next week we can have a discussion outside of the normal hours about how all the story of conformal field theory will enter here. Okay? But let's stick with the Lycon quantization for the moment. Now, the symmetry in this case is powerful enough. Of course, it will allow us to do this. The same thing we did last time. But it turns out to be powerful enough to allow us to set psi plus to zero, the whole field to zero. Okay. Now, let me write it for you. What we did last time for the x, for the minus component, from the constraint, we found that this had to be of course here the new part is this guy. But otherwise, it's exactly coming from the same computation. And that's how we can get rid of the alpha minus oscillators and the B minuses or the D minuses oscillators. We already got rid of all the plus oscillators. Well, sorry. This is only allowing us to get rid of all the alpha minus oscillators in terms of the alpha I oscillators, the BIs, or the DI oscillators. Okay? Only the transverse oscillators will enter. The same thing, of course, can be done for psi minus. And I'll write it for you what it is. It's 1 over P plus coming from the other constraint, from the superversion. Okay? Also allowing us to get rid of all the Bs minus or the D minus in favor of the alpha I's, B I's, or D I's. Okay? Okay, but having this, we are ready to go to the physical spectrum. And when we studied the physical spectrum last time, it was then that we found what the normal order ambiguity had to be. Last time, we found that it had to be equal to 1. Okay. Let's see what happens in this case. Hopefully, there will also be a particular value for A. And the last step would be to compute what? The dimension. Okay. If there is a particular dimension of the space-time that is required by the new structure of our theory. Okay? So in order to study the spectrum, we need the mass formula. Where does the mass formula come from? From which constraint? Remember, it comes from this constraint, right? And the reason is that this guy contains alpha 0 squared in the expansion, and this one is proportional to p squared, which happens to be the mass squared. Okay? Those are the little things that I would like you to remember, that the mass formula comes from this constraint, and the reason is that this guy contains these pieces. Okay? So which sector do you want to study first? Not the dwarf. Any preferences? Okay. I think we're only going to take 15 more minutes and we're going to be done. You probably want to go for lunch. So any preferences?
We have 50% chance of disrupting the lecture, so.
Well, let's take a shot. Well, okay, last time we did last time we did the Ramon sack. Now let's do the new short sack. First. So the mass formula is exactly the same thing we had before, right? Now only the transfer oscillators, as usual, right? So there is a dot here, remember? Well, we can put the dot or the eyes, doesn't matter. Let me put the sum over, sorry. Let me put the sum over the eyes explicitly here. We haven't fixed the dimension, so it's d minus 2. Okay. Now in this sector, we found that we have to sum over all half integers and okay. Pretty good. Now you will see why I said that you're going to hate the Navier-Schwarz sector compared to the other sector. And the reason is the following. Look at this. Let's study the case where, let's see what is the mass of the vacuum. Okay, of the ground state. Well, when we apply this operator to the ground state, all these guys just give you zero. Except our normal ordering constant there. Well, there is still a chance that that thing will be zero, or at least negative. But let's continue and see what happens. The first excited state what is the state with the smallest oscillator number? Well, in this case, it's actually a B, right? A B minus a half would be the state with the smallest oscillator number. By the way, this is what is called the number operator in the superstring. Okay? So the state with the smallest value of n is actually this one. And there is nothing else that mixes with this guy. So once again, this guy is a vector in space-time. But it's a vector under SO D minus 2. And immediately you should say, well, if Lorentz invariant is preserved, this guy better be massless. But what is the mass? Well, I told you that this guy had number operator eigenvalue, a half. So we get a half minus this contribution. And this better be zero. So once again, we find a non-zero constant. And our vacuum state is actually a tachyon. Now, can we have supersymmetry in space-time? You may ask, from the beginning, we had supersymmetry on the wall sheet. Do we have supersymmetry in space-time? Can we answer that question now? What do you need for supersymmetry to be a necessary condition for supersymmetry? Is that you have the same number of bosons and fermions, in particular with the same mass. Now we found this boson that is a tachyon, but we didn't find any fermionic guy with that mass. Therefore, we don't have supersymmetry in space-time. That sounds too bad. But let's continue. Okay, so we found this. Now let's do the R sector. Okay, so what is the mass formula in the R sector? It's actually something very similar to that. The usual contribution, sum over I, sum over N, plus the new contribution, minus the normal order ambiguity. This is our new number operator in the R sector. So the vacuum, we already know that the vacuum has to be massless. Okay? Well, when we apply the formula, we find that this happens to be just the normal order ambiguity because every oscillator here heals the vacuum. And for this to be massless, finally we get something that sounds sensible. We get that the normal order ambiguity has to be zero. So in the R sector, we get zero. Okay? Now we're finally ready to compute. Yeah, so in the bosonic case, the last step we did was to go on and check Lorentz invariants, right? Here we're not going to do that, okay? Instead, we're going to do something slightly different. Let's just remember these two values, okay? And what we're going to do is the following. Some of you might find what we're going to do amusing. Some of you might hate it, but it just depends on the taste. So let's actually try to determine the normal order ambiguity from the definition that is a normal order ambiguity. So what do I mean by that? Let's say in the bosonic case, okay, at the end of the discussion, I want to know who hates this and who thinks it's cool or interesting. In the bosonic case, we had that L0 was 1/2 and sum over this. Okay? Or let me put explicitly, sum over I, b minus 2, with a half. And this was the classical object, okay? This was our classical operator. And we said we had troubles to go into the quantum theory because there was a normal order ambiguity. And we could express it as follows. We could write the zero mode outside. There is no problem with this guy. This is just a number. We have the sum over positive n's. Okay. And we have the sum over negative n's. And we said these ones are fine. These ones look like operators in normal ordering, but these ones are not. If we want to proceed and imagine that Well, we don't care. Let's try to push this classical operator and write it in terms of an operator that looks at something that is normal order. We will have to commute everybody here. Okay? So if we do that, we have to commute these guys. But remember, the commutator has a factor of n, so we will commute them. At the expense of having a factor of n here. Well, this is a, let's see. So when we perform the, yeah, it doesn't matter, I guess. So now these guys, I can change the n by some minus m, just to define the sum to be positive. Now these guys are normal order again, and I can combine them with these guys to get what we like to call the L0 operator. Okay? Now there is this piece here, which looks terrible. It's the sum over all integers. Now, if this is to go into the quantum operator, our quantum operator, remember, was this guy. And A was equal to 1. So this was our quantum operator. If this guy is to go into the quantum operator, this normal order ambiguity better be equal to this normal order ambiguity here. But that seems to be a problem. Okay. Well, this is still everything inside a sum over I. Okay. Here I have a sum over I from 1 to d minus 2. So I should find something like sum over I from 1 to d minus 2, sum over all integers, will have to be equal to 1. That definitely looks like a small problem, right? If I want to push this strategy. Yeah, I think I'm missing a minus sign here. From the definition, I think this must be a minus. The reason is that what I get is the sum over all negative integers. And now if I want to write it as a sum over positive integers, I have to put a minus sign here. So what I get in order, when I compare these two things, is that this has to be equal to minus 1. Now it's going to work. Well, maybe. So the idea is the following. Clearly, this is a divergence, okay? And the divergence is coming from the zero mode, from the zero mode energies of all the oscillators. And we have an infinite number of oscillators, so we expect to have an infinite number as a vacuum energy, okay? But the vacuum energy is something that we can shift by, okay? We could add a cosmological constant to eat it up. Okay? So we can imagine that if we find a nice way of regulating that infinity, then we can perhaps make sense out of this formula. Now it turns out that there is natural regularization, which is called the Riemann zeta function regularization. And it's the following. Remember that the Riemann zeta function is something that looks like this. It's defined to be the sum from 1 to infinity of n to the z. Of course, this converges nicely when z has real value positive, right? Greater than 1. It's actually a nice convergent series. But Riemann found, I think it was in 1857, that this guy can be analytically continuous to the whole complex plane except for some poles that it's going to have. Okay? Actually, it has only one pole as theta equals 1. But otherwise, you can extend it analytically, and you get a nice analytic function everywhere. In particular, it's nicely behaved as z equals to minus 1. So this is a z plane. And this is where this representation is valid. So you can actually analytically continue and compute what its value is at this point.
And we don't have time
to actually, we can discuss it later if you want, to actually see how this happens. But the value is unique because it's an analytic continuation, and the value happens to be minus 12. Okay? That's what it is. Now, if you put minus 1 here, that looks like our formula here. So we can just say that this thing is actually minus 12, minus a 12. This guy gave us a sum over d minus 2, right, times this factor. We get 2 times 12, 24, equals to minus 1. And then guess what? It tells us that d has to be 26. So that regularization seems to be doing the job. Okay? We found from other arguments that d has to be 26. Now here what we're doing is trying to find a regularization that will extract the physical information out of this infinite sum, and the regularization seems to be the analytic continuation using the Riemann zeta function. Okay? So all I want to do is to do the same thing for, I'm only going to do it for the Navier-Schwarz sector. Yeah, this time I'm not going to ask. So let's try to do the same thing for the Navier-Schwarz sector. It's exactly the same, except that we have here an extra piece. Okay? So this is not the bosonic case anymore. This is the Navier-Schwarz sector. So we have an extra piece. Okay. Once again, this is not normal order. Okay. Half of the time is not normal order. So we can follow the same derivation and try to write it in terms of a piece that is normal order and a piece that is not. Use the anti-commutator relations. Remember, now this guy satisfies the nice normalized anti-commutation relation, so they only give a 1, okay, when I anti-commute them. So what I get in the end is a contribution that adds up to this, and it gives me something that looks like minus sum over r. R is equal to 1/2 to infinity. Okay? So now I have to compute that contribution and repeat this computation, okay? And remembering what the value of A was. This time we need a generalization of this Riemann, of the Riemann zeta function. It's just a slight generalization, actually. We put an alpha here, and this goes from 0, because now we have alpha here. Okay. And why do we need this? Because we're going to need, so the computation we want to do is the following. We have to impose that this, that comes from the sum over the transverse modes, is equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of n plus this other sum. Okay. Now we all know what this is. Okay. This looks like this function at minus 1 and at alpha equals to 1/2, right? It would be precisely this function that we have here. Because every value, it looks like an integer but shifted by 1/2. So that's precisely what we're going to be getting here if we do this, okay? Actually, it's known precisely what the analytic continuation of this thing is for any value of alpha. It's actually a polynomial. And the polynomial is, just so that you have it, is that. Now, if you plug in this value, you get the answer happens to be minus 1 over 24. And that's what you're supposed to put here. Okay? And this is supposed to be equal to our number here, which is minus 1/2, that we computed from the requirement that we had Lorentz invariance in the Navier-Schwarz sector. Okay? Now, putting this whole thing together, what do we get? We get d halves over, so we get 2 times 24 times 3 must be equal to 1/2. Okay? Minus sign is canceled, we get this, and we end the lecture by doing this complicated computation today, which I hope all of you have done. So we cancel this, and we find that d minus 2 is equal to 8, and therefore the dimension for the superstring happens to be 10. So this is our new space-time dimension. So everything, all the spectrum must fall into nice representations of SO9,1. Okay? So we stop here. Sorry for going over time, but I knew you wouldn't be able to spend the whole weekend without knowing that the space-time dimension actually was 10.
So my friend, this homework number 2, I really do.